Welcome to Justice Visions, a podcast about everything new in the domain of transitional justice. Justice Visions is hosted at the Human Rights Centre of Ghent University. For more information, visit justicevisions.org. Welcome to this new episode of Justice Visions, in our third episode of a mini-series which is on transitional justice and protest. And in that mini-series, we're looking at what the revolutionary root, but also the revolutionary potential of transitional justice is when it's used in more non-scripted ways or when parts of the transitional justice toolkit or rhetoric are used by, say, social movements. With me today is my co-host, Sira Payías-Peró. She's a postdoctoral researcher at Justice Visions. Welcome, Sira.
Thank you.
In today's episode, we're going to be zooming in on the United States and the struggle for reparations for enslavement of people of African descent, as well as for the associated legacy of systemic racism and dispossession of African Americans.
And we'll explore how the struggle can be understood in the light of the last two episodes, in which we talk about the MENA region and in the case of Peru, and where we also discussed how activists try to tap into this disruptive potential of transitional justice language and initiatives.
And with us today is Professor Joyce Hope Scott. She is a clinical professor of African American and Black Diaspora Studies at Boston University. And she's also co-founder of the International Network of Scholars and Activists for African Reparations, which is also called INASAR, which is an international network dedicated to reparations and to other forms of transitional justice for the enslavement and the genocide of peoples of African descent. Welcome, Joyce.
Thank you so much.
Joyce, we've invited you to talk about the fight for reparations for slavery in the US, but in a podcast, of course, dealing with transitional justice. And in the domain of transitional justice, I think it's fair to say that reparations are typically seen as part of a wider political project that's also about contributing to rebuilding trust between citizens, but also between citizens and the state, which is also about the construction of a new political community by remedying, by acknowledging violations and violence of the past. And what's striking then, of course, is that in this context, even if the US is not a typical case of transitional justice, all of these ambitions, of course, are also highly relevant. And so as such, the call for reparations has become increasingly widespread. And I was wondering, as a first question for our listeners who are not so familiar with this debate, if you could tell us a bit more about the history of these claims for reparations for African American people in the United States.
I like to preface my discussion of African Americans' struggle in the United States by locating it in a global context. And that is to say that what's called transatlantic slavery, which of course was trafficking, was not a trade at all, affected the continent of Africa, the continent of Europe, South America, North America, Asia. There's not a continent that was not affected in some way or other by the forced movement of African people. This forced movement, of course, represents a theft, a lost displacement, and it initiated an ongoing and continual movement or migration of those people and to a status of kind of a homelessness or exileness, particularly as it applies to those people in North America and more so than in the Caribbean. This is the case because after slavery was over, there was no quote unquote resettlement of those people on land where they could in fact engage in some kind of restorative process of healing, of citizenship building, of community building, of family rebuilding, and those kinds of things. So reparations for slavery is a global movement that advocates the position that restitution and repair are due to African descended people. This theft of people and their humanity, their uncompensated labor, the genocide, the illegal and inhuman trafficking that their ancestors were involved in. And also, since the abolition of slavery in the Caribbean in the 1830s and the broader Americans in the 1860s and 80s, the progeny of these original people have continued to suffer horrific crimes So this struggle, in fact, is not a new one. It is a very old notion. The idea of reparations is quite old in the United States. So while the United Nations proclaimed in 2013 the International Decade of People of African Descent, it was preceded by a number of actions generated by former victims in the United States. But in terms of an official legal action, maybe the very first one, we trace back to 1783, a case brought against Isaac Arroyo by Belinda Sutton, who had been in captivity to him. And she filed a claim with the Massachusetts General Court of Massachusetts and sued for reparations. Following that, you had a number of other movements, the Declaration of the National Anti-Slavery Convention in 1833. These are all in the United States. Then we go earlier into the 20th century with Paul Robeson and his famous words, "We charge genocide," petition of 1950, to even Dr. Martin Luther King's memorial address in 1963, which he used the words, "We've come to collect," on a check that has bounced, and the idea that he's talking about reparations. You have the Republic of New Africa in 1968, or James Forman's Black Manifesto. This is a very old, long struggle in the United States. And now what we may all be familiar with, of course, is the H.R. 40 piece first set out by John Conyers in 1989, but finally has seen the light of day in Congress. So that's been a hearing at which many, many people participated, including Daddy Glover, Ta-Nehisi Coates, and people of that nature. So that's where we are nationally in terms of some very brief background to reparations in the United States.
Thank you so much for offering that map. It also makes me wonder, if we fast forward to today's situation, if you could talk a bit more about the nature of the demands that are being made, by which I mean, of course, reparations can take on a range of forms. And especially, I think, within the practice of transitional justice, it's been, you know, conceptualized as restitution or compensation, but also symbolic reparations are possible in the form of acknowledgement, recognition of suffering, apologies, memorials, commemorations, you name it. And I was wondering if you could speak a bit more to the question of what the nature of the most pressing or the most visible demands, in a way, is for the historical and ongoing harms and the struggle as it's shaping up today.
You targeted the issue quite nicely in saying, in listing all of those features of reparations. I think that one of the biggest issues around reparations today is the discussion about what constitutes reparations. What would it be? A lot of effort in the past has been focused from the legal, political, and economic circles around a kind of restitution or compensation, if you will, or an attempt to attach a financial compensation to the harm that was done by enslavement. I think most people and many organizations like COBRA and NARCO and other national organizations like that, as well as many scholars and so on, would disclaim that as the solution, because indeed, the point of the matter is what happened to captive African people is not something that can be paid for. That's the first thing. What people are seeing more and more now is that the idea of reparations is restorative justice. It is transitional justice because it indeed extends beyond the event of slavery. It is the things that happen, the legacy and the subsequent force of that enslavement that concerns people a lot today, because the fallout, if I might use that term, from that has been vicious, and it is visceral and visible today across the country in this period following slavery. There was another period that someone like Professor Douglas Blackman calls slavery by another name. And that is, we talk about the convict lease system, where people were picked up for vagrancy. That was a way to get the South free labor again, back again. These things are a part of the call for reparations. These things are what people want repaired, addressed in terms of atonement or apology or transitional justice. Giving money to people who were enslaved is a non-conversation. Obviously, their descendants suffered. And if there is going to be any kind of restitution monetarily, of course, we have to consider that the people aren't even here anymore, but their descendants are continuing to justly get the restitution and the compensation that they need. So the conversation is moving to be more inclusive than just the act of enslavement, to look at the harm, the dispossession, and the visceral racism that infected every institution in this country. And thus, because of that, affects the opportunities, the life chances, and the performance of citizenship that has been awarded to Black people. Let me just say, they may not all be people who descended directly from slavery, but people who are Black people and African descended people in this country suffer and get the brunt of the racist structure that has been in place. This is a thing that has to be addressed. Thus, the need for transitional justice, absolutely. Though we're not a country in transition, we are a country in transition, essentially, away from something visceral and vicious like racism.
I would like to ask you a couple of questions about the InnoSAR project. One of the aims of the project is to change precisely the public misconceptions about reparations and reparative justice. Can you tell us a bit more about what these misconceptions are?
Yes, that is essentially InnoSAR's main mission. And that is the first thing that we talk about, misconceptions that InnoSAR wants to change. Just the term slaves. The people captured and trafficked were not slaves. They were regular people like you and me, who were priests and priestesses, who were farmers, who were warriors, mostly warriors, who were seers, who were royal people, who were of all spectrums of life, who were just suddenly and abruptly taken from their homes, from their lands, and so on, to which they never returned. They were misnamed and reassigned statuses. They were never, ever again allowed the chance to be Fon, to be Ashanti, to be Ewe, to be Manding, to be Tuareg, or whatever they were. They were henceforth Negroes, or worse yet, the other N-word, colored people, and the hundreds of other names that they were given. This is the first misconception, that we're talking about a trade. There was no trade. You had a body of people stolen and trafficked across the Atlantic that were turned into chattel property, that were misnamed and dehumanized and used in every aspect of their being for the benefit, the undeserved benefit of somebody else. So we first decided it's the language that needs to be changed. The idea that slavery is over and its effects are over is what now makes us use the term mangamizi. It's a Swahili word. It's an ongoing harm, ongoing dispossession. There's a big movement to look at the language to make sure that we wrest from the hegemonic structure, from the imperialist discourse, those terms that the affected communities best feel identify them. The other misconception is that we are talking about the possibility of rectification of the harm by a check of some type. But again, it's too easy to say, okay, we've given you your $100,000, so now go away and don't bother us again. That is not what this is about. And also, people who have dominated the conversation and have done a wonderful job, I'm not criticizing them, the legal scholars, the economists, the historians who've gone back and done extraordinary work of getting valid information. So the conversation has remained there at the level of scholarship. Again, not allowing indigenous knowledge to come through. Not only indigenous people of Africa, but the indigenous people of the Caribbean, of North and South America, who are the regular people who are in a state of dispossession now. They have not spoken. There is no way to restore, to repair people who are not at the table. Other kinds of misunderstandings is that slavery, the transatlantic version, was something that somehow concerns those people in the diaspora who were the victims of that trafficking or the descendants of, and not Africa. We in InnoSAR and our constituency see an unbroken link, an inseparable connection between the African continent and those who stayed and those who left. And what are the implications of the psychic, the spiritual, the emotional damage of that creation of orphans. Because what we are, as Marlene Norbesi Phillips calls it, we are, she said, epistemological orphans. So there's a whole effort of research and of reconnection that we do at the level of Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous people who are going to help us fill that in and help broaden and make more effective. So the conversations gets much bigger, much more global. And the implication behind this idea of transitional justice, that is not going to happen again, that it will be healing.
This is really interesting. And there's one thing that you mentioned in your answer that I would like to pick up in my next question. You were saying that there is this need to expand on the focus of legal and economic arguments for reparations to include cultural, spiritual, environmental, psychological approaches. And I would like to ask you, could you give us maybe an example of good practices that you have been able to identify through the network of InnoSAR?
I think that there are some good reparatory efforts that are being made. In the United States, there are cities, there's the state of California that is looking at making available housing opportunities and so on. I think that there are good things that are happening. I think people are, the restoration of sites of memory that have been erased relative to the experience of captive Africans, just the revelation of hidden truths and hidden realities of universities coming forth and acknowledging their role in the trafficking of African people. The Bank of England recently acknowledging, the church and places. I think these are good things that are happening. And so I refer to them as positive kinds of gestures by way of opening the dialogue and broadening the dialogue. What I also want to emphasize, which is not so well known, which I think is crucial, is what I'm calling efforts at rematriation. Rematriation is a term that Indigenous people of North America, Aba Yala, have talked about. And it is the idea of revalorization, cultural, spiritual, psychic, psychological reconnection. And in InnoSAR, we've got our current project, which is rematriation and planet repairs. This is an issue of the planet. If you think about the African cultures that people came from, these were traditional people who were bound to the land and they weren't separate from the land. These movements among Indigenous people to preserve, to revalorize, to reclaim, to teach the young, in other words, to dispossess them of the colonized mind, which is the big danger, the big legacy, in addition to racism, is also the colonial ideology of deficiency that was implanted in the minds of the people that were colonized. These efforts on the parts of traditional people, community people, even schools, to relearn or to pass on to children their culture in the face of the dominance of, let's say, English or French or Portuguese or whatever school systems that were imposed upon them. So there are efforts on the parts of these people to address that, to indeed reclaim the minds of themselves and their children. It's not a big, massive movement, but it's something that encourages me. What we do as InnoSAR, we've written a number of articles together, scholars and activists. We've got reports. We were able to get what is called the Porto Novo Declaration in our international conference of 2018 in the Republic of Benin, signed by the dynastic kings, all of them, to support the idea of reparations and to call on the AU to, in fact, support all restorative justice and reparatory actions. These are encouraging to me. The efforts at universities to claim their role in the trade and the gestures they're making are encouraging. None of this in any way gets close to solving the problem, but I'm encouraged by these efforts.
And I'm listening to how you structure your answer around like all these new conceptualizations, all these initiatives happening. And I'm wondering, what are the implications of these dynamics and of this particular struggle that you're describing for the broader field of transitional justice?
Yes, I think that once countries say, we apologize, the next step is some action. There's a taunt out there that has to be addressed. What are you going to do now? the next step is to sit and discuss with the people that have been harmed. The biggest mistake that we're have been heading toward is people who were engaged in the ill, in the wrong, wanting to determine what the resolution should be. This has to be changed because the people who are implicated have to be at the table. They have to say what they need. In fact, they said what they needed in the United States right after, and other places. In fact, Brazil, Jamaica, right after slavery was abolished, they said, what we want is land. What we want is land of our own where we can go and build our community and heal together. The operative word here is heal, because they knew they had been damaged, but what had been done to them was not a violation just of their physical body, their labor, etc. What has been done, as the United Nations points out, is a crime against humanity. That has to be addressed. And in order to address it, it is a global issue, because the building of the Atlantic world, the modern world as we know it, was built on the backs of enslaved African people and their labor, and their dehumanization and inhuman treatment. That has to be addressed. It has to be acknowledged. People have to say, I'm sorry. And what can I do? How can I make this up? What do you need? I don't mean to minimize and make fun of this thing. It's not that way. But my point is, it's very simple. The unearned assets and the unearned wealth that people got didn't go anywhere. Money never loses value. It just augments. It goes from family to family. And as one group of people profited, the others were affected and dispossessed. So that has to be addressed. And it's a harder conversation because now it's so much easier to say, we're just going to write a check and say goodbye. That is not what's going to happen. It cannot happen that way. We've missed all those opportunities to do other kinds of things. It has to do with land. It has to do with healing of those whose souls were ripped apart by this event. And that is the most important thing that has to be on the table first and foremost. And the people themselves are the ones that will tell us how that should happen.
I want to maybe link that to a conversation that we've had with a couple of other guests in this miniseries, which is a conversation about accountability, which by all means is a building block of transitional justice. But then, of course, with the kind of harm and injustice and violence that you're talking about, that necessarily, I think, takes on a very different form from what we typically observe in kind of more paradigmatic transitional justice cases. And I was wondering if you could speak a bit to that point of how we could start to think about accountability in a way that makes sense in these specific struggles.
I think that a forum was instituted with the Durban Conference. I think that was an opportunity to begin that conversation. And indeed, it was begun, except by those who walked out because they didn't want to face the issue of racism. So I think that that is a mechanism that's been set in place globally. The United Nations, the occasion for the nations to come together and discuss issues. The ills that are happening that are results of enslavement and colonization and neocolonialism, which continues to reign supreme here in the world today, is not something that has happened in the past. It's continuing to happen right now. There will probably not be so easy to get a global meeting of everybody sitting around the table who are implicated in this crime on the state level, at the level of statehood. That probably will not be easy. But what I think can work and seems to be working is what's going on at local and city and state levels. People are coming together. The people of California decided that they wanted this. The people of Ohio decided this. The students at Harvard University and the faculty decided they wanted that honor to Isaac Royale taken down from the law school. They decided that. And here is why I say that. The reason that slavery worked and colonialism worked is because of laws. Laws that were constructed, not natural and moral laws, those convenient laws that were put in place to hold people in captivity, to strip them of their rights, to protest, and all those other kinds of things across the globe. my approach has been, you've got to understand how this worked, and it worked because of law. And to undo something that was done by law is what has been happening in the United States since the 1954 Supreme Court decision, since the Civil Rights Acts of 64, 65, and 75, and so on and so forth. These are initiatives that are legally undoing, deconstructing those things that have been put in place. There are international laws about reparations that are due. We don't have to come up with new laws. They're on the books. Thankfully, after World War II, because of the horrors that happened in during that genocide, these international laws have been put in place. Harm was done. A crime was done. How can you handle it? Conversations need to be happening at local, at the level of communities, of students, of churches, or other religious organizations, and so on. The people, the people, the people. The people implicated and those of goodwill who see the necessity to right a terrible wrong. Those people who are profiting and profiteering are not anxious to sit down at the table and do anything that's going to rock their boats. But it's the people themselves who've always been the ones who initiated the changes. That is what I believe.
Thank you so much. And I actually think that you're also answering what we typically always ask as a last question of our interviewees, which is where you look for inspiration and which evolutions you see that make you hopeful that change can happen. So I think you actually have answered that question already. So I am just going to wrap up by just thanking you for this very encompassing and very in-depth also understanding that you've shared with us. I have another 10 questions at least that I want to ask you, but what we will do instead is we will just link to your work and the work of Inosar in the show notes so that people can also read more about it if they want more information. And now I'm just going to thank you. And for our listeners, we have one last episode of this miniseries on TJ and protest next month. Joyce, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
This was Justice Visions. To re-listen to this episode or to browse our archive, visit our website, justicevisions.org, or subscribe now via Spotify or Apple Music. Justice Visions is made possible through generous funding of the European Research Council.